Happy International Marconi Day, everyone.
Hooray!
It's when the world celebrates the father of radio, Guglielmo Marconi. He didn't actually invent modern radio, but he's credited with making wireless telegraphs commercially successful. Turns out the radio operators on board the Titanic were employed by Marconi, and they used his equipment to alert a nearby ship, resulting in around 700 survivors. International Marconi Day is a 24-hour holiday celebrated by amateur radio enthusiasts who spend the day communicating with Marconi sites around the world. Today, we'll be celebrating by bringing you radio-inspired stories, starting off with local radio personality Brian Copeland.
Hello again, this is Brian Copeland talking, and I'm here with you on Sundays from a few minutes after 1 until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I hope
Copeland has a weekly show on KGO. Today, he's a radio personality, actor, comedian, writer, and performer, but like many of us, he says he got to where he is today thanks to a series of coincidences, like how he accidentally ended up hosting his first live radio show at age 12.
My whole career is a fluke. Everything in my career, it's like, it's not, you know, it didn't end up the way that I thought it was. Actually, even better. It's just I stumbled into things.
Copeland tells the story of his life in his acclaimed show called Not a Genuine Black Man. It first hit the stage in 2004 and was originally scheduled to run for 6 weeks. That turned into 7 years, becoming the longest-running one-man show in San Francisco history. It comes back to the stage tonight at the Berkeley Rep for its 10th anniversary. Brian says he first got the idea for his show by sheer coincidence. He was going through a pile of listener mail at the radio station.
And there was one that was typewritten that just for some reason stuck out. And I opened it up and it said, "As an African American, I'm disgusted every time I hear your voice because you were not a genuine black man." And I said, bingo, that's it. For some reason, most of my adult life, I've heard that nonsense from African Americans and white people alike. "Oh, you're not really black." "Yeah, you are, but you're not one of those blacks." "Okay, well, you know, that kind of nonsense." So I go to this whole litany about why do they say that, how I dress, how I talk, because I like watching Frasier on television, you know. And I thought, okay, I realized it was because I grew up the only black face in the room when we moved to San Leandro, California, which bordered Oakland.
Back when you were a genuine black
person. Yeah, yeah. I didn't even know about that. Back when I was 8 years old, and San Leandro was 99% white. So I said, I'm going to write a story about what it was like to be the only one. Because everybody at some point is going to be the only one, the only man, the only woman, the only black, the only white, the only Catholic, the only Muslim. And how do you navigate that situation when you were the one who's different? So I would walk my 3 kids to school. They were first grade, fifth grade, and seventh grade. I'd gone through a divorce, and I had custody of them all by myself. So that was another reason I was spinning my wheels, because I couldn't go on the road. I, you know, was packing lunches and chaperoning field trips. So I dropped them at school, and I sat at this little cafe by my house in San Leandro, where I still live, marble composition notebooks, and I wrote every story I could think of about what it was like to grow up the only one. You know, some were funny, some were sad. There were a lot of things I'd repressed and deliberately repressed because they were so incredibly painful. So this went on for about maybe 9 months, and by the time I was done with that, I had maybe a dozen or more of these marble composition notebooks, front and back, you know, number 2 natural wood pencils. That was my process. So I thought, okay, I got enough raw material. Why don't I go to the library and find out what was going on in town at that time to give it some kind of context? Mm-hmm. So I go to the library, and Cindy Simmons was the head librarian. God love her. She's since written a book about San Leandro, too. And I told Cindy, I'm thinking about writing a book about what it was like to grow up here when there weren't many black folks. And I got something you need to see. So she takes me in the back, opens up the file cabinet, and pulls out this yellowing stack of typewritten papers. And what it was a sociology paper written for a class at Cal State Hayward, now Cal State East Bay, in 1967 by a San Leandro resident named Don Magnifico. And it was called How San Leandro's 10 Homeowners Associations Keep the City an All-White Ghetto. And I went, what? I mean, I knew I'd had a rough time, but I didn't realize that this was known.
That it was policy.
So I started flipping through this thing, and he had talked to contemporary residents, and he had done some investigating, come to find out that the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights had conducted hearings in 1968. seven, they wanted to know why Oakland next door was something like 50% black, whereas when you hit the San Leandro border, suddenly it's 99% white. So I thought, wow, now my entire story's changed. Now it's not just my story, it's the story of an evolution of a city.
You know, if you paint your face black, you get a new Cadillac and the county will come in and feed your family. What do they call it? Prejudice or something? That's all they got to holler and they got it made. You let a f***er throw them and stop me, I got to pay.
Hey, you ain't kidding. Let me be starving and stealing a loaf of bread to feed my family. My ass is going to jail. Ain't nobody behind me hollering prejudice.
You know, there's only one way to solve this thing between us, and that's going to be with a revolution. I'm for fighting it out between us. Just give me a machine gun.
Yeah, the sucker went out and bought me some guns.
You know what we need around here? Now, I'll tell you what we need around here. We need a Hitler here to take care of the troublemakers like he did with them Jews in Germany. That's what we need around here.
Now, I don't know what you're probably thinking. That's Birmingham, right? Or Providence, Rhode Island. I get confused sometimes. That is San Leandro in 1972. Newsweek magazine came to town as part of a cover story on Richard Nixon's forgotten white majority, and they interviewed these two charming gentlemen. That exchange is verbatim. San Leandro, California.
And that's Brian Copeland. He's performing his one-man show, Not a Genuine Black Man, at Berkeley Rep. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Cross Currents. So the show is, it's funny, and it's really painful, and it's poignant. To do it for you, is it cathartic? Is it, you know, is it painful? Like, what is it like for you to actually relive this?
Well, I have to go to those dark places in order for it to be real for the audience. And I have found that I cannot do this show more than like three or four times a week. The show went off Broadway. And we were off Broadway. It was like eight performances a week. And, you know, this show deals with so many different issues, domestic mm-hmm. violence being one of them. Mm-hmm. And there's a domestic violence scene. And I can't beat my mother twice on Saturday and twice on Sunday, you know, in front of an audience. And it really started to get to me doing that many performances. But I do have to go to the places. I talk about my depression in this. And I've got to go to this place where I was sitting in my car back in 1999 with the top down and the motor running, saying that this is it. And I've got to go and remember what those feelings were and relive that in order to make it real for the audience. That's my method as an actor. So as far as cathartic, I don't know that I would say it's cathartic because I dealt with those issues, you know. But there are parts of it that are painful because of the fact that I have to go there. The other issue is I lost my mother is a central character in this play.
She's wonderful. She's got this quiet dignity that's just amazing. Mm-hmm. I love your grandma, too.
Yeah, mom and grandma. And I lost my mother when I was 14. Mm-hmm. And at the time, grandma was still alive when I started to do the show. And the other part of the show is it gives me an opportunity to spend time with her, if that makes any sense.
It makes a lot of sense, yeah. So is she your favorite character to portray? Do you have a favorite? Because you really come alive when you're portraying your family.
Yeah. Oh, grandma, definitely.
Grandma.
I would say grandma, you know. Grandma, no nonsense.
From Alabama.
From Birmingham. Tells it like it is. Whereas my mother was what black folks call siddity. You know, she put on airs.
Yes,
you know,
she's from Providence, Rhode Island.
She's born in Birmingham, but would tell people that she was born in Providence, Rhode Island, because it sounded better.
And she has the most sort of proper accent in the whole.
Yes, if we said the word ain't in my house as a child, we may as well have said the F word. I mean, that's how my mother was.
That's Brian Copeland. His show at the Berkeley Rep is Not a Genuine Black Man. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. So obviously, Not a Genuine Black Man explores identity and, you know, individuality versus group identity and race, class, and geography. How have you come to think about your own identity after doing all of this soul searching?
Well, what I think really the point of this is that nobody has the right to define you but you.
What is it that makes the racial authenticity of a successful black male suspect? What is it? I mean, it really pisses me off when I think about it. Because here on the street corners of Oakland, you have all these guys selling crack. And all these guys with five babies by five different women, none of whom they're supporting, and nobody's saying they're not real black men. Or guys like Sylvester. He abused me, he abused my mother, he abandoned us, he never worked, never brought money home, and nobody ever once accused him of not being a genuine black man. Nobody ever said to him, you're an abusive, parasitic piece of shit, and you're not black. I mean, is that what I gotta do? I mean, I have to be Sylvester? I have to be the worst possible stereotype, or I'm not keeping it real? Well, in that case, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I don't deal drugs. I'm sorry that all my kids were born into wedlock. I'm sorry that I help them with their homework and I support them. I'm sorry that I don't tell them if they get good grades that they're acting white. I'm sorry that I don't think that a guy disrespecting women by rhyming about to the sound of a bass guitar is music. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I want to live in a nice neighborhood where I'm not kept awake at night by gunshots, screams, and sirens. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I look so in an orange jumpsuit that I'm not going to prison for anybody. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I care more about a 401k than a 187 PC. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry!
And that's Brian Copeland. He's performing his one-man show, Not a Genuine Black Man, at Berkeley Rep. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Cross Currents. How much do you think our society has changed since the time period in which your show takes place, which is the 70s and the 80s? How much do you think we've evolved in terms of, you know, California's now a no-majority state. Everybody is a minority here. Mm-hmm. How much do you think we've changed? Where do you see change?
Well, I think that we certainly see change in terms of what society will tolerate as far as language is concerned. And in today's society, being called a racist is about the worst possible thing that you can be called. It really is. The impact that it'll have on your life and on your livelihood to be tagged with that label. So people are much more underground about it. I think that things have changed in that regard. I do believe that a lot of the same issues that happened in that show that took place 40 years ago are we're still dealing with today. I'm walking down the street as an 8-year-old boy with a baseball bat, and basically I was profiled, you know, and here we are, Trayvon Martin walking down the street, you know, just minding his own business and gets killed, and it's his fault. You know, they decide that it's his fault in some way.
Let's actually hear that clip from the show. Let me go ahead and play that for everybody as a tease for Brian Copeland's show, Not a Genuine Black Man.
These stories are all the same if you were a black male in this society, be you 8, 18, 28, 38, walking, riding your bike, or running away from kids who want to kill you. The first question is always the same. You have any identification? I'm 8. All right, where'd you get the bat? And ball. Well, I used my birthday money. I went to Sears. My sister wanted to get... You got a receipt? What are you, my accountant? All right, where do you live? In Kendon Village. Which Kendon Village? There's more than one. The apartments around here somewhere. You know, maybe you better show me. He gestures towards the police car. I reach for the passenger side door. He says, uh-uh, just a minute. He takes my bat, my ball, puts them on the hood of the car, and then I am officially baptized as a black male in this society. He has me raise my arms up, and he pats me down. I'm 8 years old. I'm thinking, gee, I hope he doesn't find the bazooka I have hidden on me. What does he think, that I'm like a midget Black Panther outside agitator here to start a militant school lunch program in his city or something?
And that's Brian Copeland. He's performing his one-man show, Not a Genuine Black Man, at Berkeley Rep. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Cross Currents. Do you ever worry that people who kind of do want to blame the situation that a lot of black men are faced with right now, high incarceration rates, really high poverty rates, very low educational achievements, that they could take some of, you know, you're talking about individual responsibility and kind of, you know, blame black men for their plight?
Well, in terms of personal responsibility, partly yes, but then you look at, you mentioned high incarceration rates. Well, you know, black males are disproportionately incarcerated. And what that means is that you have situations where if an African-American young man is committed a crime, he goes to jail for it. Where you can have a white boy in the same situation, same age range, who the courts will go easier on. They'll say, well, he made a mistake. And he made a mistake, and so we don't want to ruin his life, so probation. And so that's the difference. I mean, you look, for God's sakes, look at that affluenza case in Texas. You know, this rich kid, rich white kid, gets drunk and kills four people with his car. And his defense is that he suffered from affluenza, a condition brought on by having so much money you think that it insulates you from problems. And the judge bought it and gave this kid probation. Four people dead. Do you think for a second in the state of Texas that if this had been a black kid who gotten drunk and killed four people, and there were people in his car that were paralyzed, a young lady was paralyzed, you think for a second that he wouldn't have gone to jail? Or they wouldn't have considered his background. I mean, come on. I mean, that does not happen in cases with African-American men who are charged with crimes.
Well, and I guess I wonder with your show, I mean, you do crossover. You reach a lot of audiences that maybe don't think about these things. Yeah. Is that what you're trying to do? Who are you talking to? I mean, it seems like you're trying to talk to a lot of people.
Well, here's the thing with that show. I never had an agenda with that show. I'm just telling a story. Mm. And that's the thing. People will come to me and say, oh, I got what you were trying to say. Well, I'm just telling a story. I'm telling a story. Here's what happened. You know, you take from it what you want.